Welcome to hour two of In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The legislative session in South Dakota is in full swing. Joining me now is SDPB's political reporter, Lee Strubinger. We'll talk about a few bills that might change the ballot measure process in South Dakota. Lee, thanks for joining us on In the Moment.
Thank you for having me.
You're in Rapid City still?
Yes.
All right. We're reaching him from the studios in Rapid City. I know the weather is looking kind of interesting, so I'm making sure you're safe there.
Yeah. I'm safe here for now.
All right. You're seeing some legislation that's changing the ballot measure process in the state. Tell us a little bit about it.
Right. Well, you know, as you recall, and I think we all recall, there were several ballot measures that were up for a vote in November. Some of those ballot measures kind of directly opposed one another. For instance, the two interest rate loan caps, one that established that passed that established a 36% cap, and then the other that was for an 18% for loans, or an 18% cap for loans unless a different rate was agreed to in writing. The measure the payday loan industry was backing attempted to kind of gum up the 36% rate cap ballot measure, both in the Secretary of State's office and in the courts. And I do apologize for using a lot of numbers just now. Essentially, the Secretary of State, Chantel Krebs, and the Board of Elections brought forth some language that she says clarifies state statute about what's challengeable in her office and the courts.
So what's her reason for that? Is the Secretary of State's job to sort of look at those submitted positions?
Yeah, yes.
Petitions.
Petitions, right. No, you're right. But the given the number of ballot measures this year and the number of challenges her office received in regards to those petitions, she says it kind of became too much. It was like flooding her office. During her testimony last week, she said that her office went through five different court cases just this past summer alone, one of them which is still pending. And that's exactly the strategy that these various interest groups have used to try and keep measures off the ballot.
So what's she wanting to do? What exactly needs to be clarified?
Well, Secretary Krebs says that her office was getting challenged on things like verifying that a petitioner actually witnessed signatures on a petition. And she was also asked to verify signatures that aren't included in the 5% random sample that her office looks at. Krebs said her office checked and verified around 18,000 signatures this last election. And she said with a staff of four, that makes it tough to stay on top of. Krebs basically said her office could be challenged to infinity in court.
Any citizen can challenge those petitions. And so essentially this was cleanup language based on some court cases and court challenges. So it's very clear in statute what has to be brought in, when it has to be brought in, the proper form. So essentially this is cleanup language to clarify that. So there's no question. And then also the process of how it can be challenged. Because anybody, again, any citizen can challenge the process.
I know there are some people out there who kind of feel that the change to the petition challenging process sort of favors opponents rather than supporters of a ballot measure. Could you address that a little bit?
I would disagree with that because of all the court cases we've had and all the process as far as opponents or those that are questioning the process. That's the beauty of it, is that anybody can, you know, challenge it in court. They could challenge our office with specific defined deficiencies. So it's very clear and it's a very open process that, again, any citizen can do this. Any citizen can challenge a candidate or a ballot question.
So there are still some concerns about the protections that this change to the ballot measure process has and possible, advantage for somebody opposing a ballot measure or challenging her acceptance of one as opposed to, being denied on the grounds that it was deficient. Secretary Krebs is basically just saying she hopes not to get tied up in litigation over what her office sees as innocuous or even unverifiable claims, and that those sort of claims can play out in the courts.
All right. There's another bill you're following that delays the implementation of the approved ballot measures, right?
Correct. This bill had two sections. The first section looks at delaying the implementation of an approved ballot measure to July 1st, which is when state legislation typically goes into effect.
So what's behind that? Why would lawmakers want to delay the implementation of a voter-approved ballot measure?
Well, Republican Senator Jim White of Huron brought the ballot measure, or brought this measure, sorry, forward. And he says he wants to push back the implementation date to July 1st so that, that departments and industries that are impacted by a ballot measure have time to react.
As it stands right now, as soon as it's canvassed, it becomes law. And a lot of times there are funding mechanisms necessary to implement it. And it, and our, we don't even start our budget process until February and March, finishes in April. And then the other laws become effective as far as legislation is concerned on July 1st. So I just use that date as a basis so it's consistent with what we are doing.
And that also gives lawmakers the chance to sort of fiddle with an approved ballot measure like we've seen this year with the initiated Measure 22. They have some time to sort of unpack it. Is that right?
Well, that's certainly an argument that's out there. And that's kind of that's kind of why the second section of the bill existed, which basically said that initiated measures would be subject to the same constitutionality requirements that apply to measures that are put forth by state legislators. As you know, initiated Measure 22 is being challenged on its constitutionality in the courts.
And there's a section of this that got removed?
Right. The Section 2 was removed. Democratic leadership did question the constitutionality of that section, saying that it wasn't well written. And Senator White says he received a lot of input and concern from the public, so he decided to pull that part of the bill. He says the public took it as threatening, but that wasn't his original intention.
So initiated Measure 22, injunction in court, and then it's also on its way in the State House to getting repealed. Tell us about what happened last night, Lee.
So after about 2 hours of testimony, both for and against the voter-approved campaign finance, lobbying ethics commission, publicly funded campaign finance system reform bill, the big massive thing that we've been reporting on, the House State Affairs Committee voted 10-3 in favor of repealing initiated Measure 22.
What's that mean going forward?
It means that state lawmakers are delivering on their promise to repeal IM-22. And as far as replacing goes, there are a few bills that lawmakers have submitted that are similar to what IM-22 sought to do.
And this is how they're trying to respond to what the voter intent might be, sort of measures to please the voters. Is that what I'm hearing or understanding?
Correct. At least that's how it seems.
One of the What do we got looking at?
Sure. Yeah. One of the bills would establish a government accountability board, which would be a 6-member bipartisan group that can investigate misuse of public funds, conflicts of interest, wrongdoing, theft, bribery, those sorts of things, which was one of the criticisms of the Ethics Commission that IM-22 brought forward. They were saying that it wouldn't do that. It didn't do that.
Sure.
Another one of these measures would limit the gifts that lawmakers, or the language says it would limit the gifts lawmakers can receive from lobbyists to no more than $100 per calendar year. And that was almost exact language from initiated Measure 22. An exemption does exist in that bill, however, for food and drinks that are immediately consumed.
Okay.
and then there's another bill that mirrors kind of the rhetoric that we heard from Governor Dennis Dugard. Recall that he said in his State of the State address he wanted to limit out-of-state money from influencing South Dakota politics. This one bill looks at banning ballot question committees from being funded at or more than 75% of out-of-state money, basically.
Interesting. That'll be an interesting one to follow, the whole set of them. Lee Strubinger, stay safe in the weather, and we thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks. South Dakota has named its 2017 Teacher of the Year. She's a sixth grade math teacher at Yankton Middle School. Meet Beth Keltsoulis.
Do something that would help others. And I feel like teaching is one of those occupations, and there's many of them in the world, but I was born the oldest of 11. And so from my very earliest time that I can remember, I was teaching. I was helping somebody in the family do something. And so I think it just came naturally to me, and it's all I've known. And so I'll just keep doing it because I get a great payback from it every day.
So we have $48 that we spent for six tickets. Maybe we went to see the Minnesota Twins.
I have always loved teaching math.
You all understood the ratio part of it, but it was the batting average that was kind of sticky for you. So
probably the reason is, as a kid, that was the hardest subject for me. I found that most difficult. I loved to read as a student, but I had troubles problem solving. And I'd get frustrated because people would be helpful in giving me the answer, but they wouldn't be helpful in helping me solve the problem. And so I saw a real need for that when I trained to be a teacher.
So how much does each egg cost, class?
10 cents.
I try to help them understand that what we're learning now, they're going to need later on, and try to apply that to their daily life or what will be their adult life.
My husband drives a truck, and he gets 14 miles to the gallon. Let's see how far he can go in his truck on one tank of gas.
She does a really good job at explaining, and she puts the lessons we're learning into our daily lives, like figuring out 70s if you could buy 8 eggs for 76 cents or 12 eggs for $1.08. And then we'd have to figure this out in a store, and she puts that into our daily lives.
Every ounce of laundry detergent you use, you're going to save a penny, aren't you?
She makes it more fun because it's funny and stuff. She, like, points out people and pretends they're the person. Like, it was a real estate problem about money and stuff, and she was, like, giving people the titles of the story problems. It was pretty fun.
And you're telling your wife, you know what? If I don't have some clean underwear tomorrow, I'm not going to be able to go to work.
I'm always the first one to make fun of myself first. You know, I'm the short, chubby old woman, and so I'm good material. And if they see I'm doing that, then they have fun with it, and they don't feel bad when I'm... I always tell them, if I'm picking on you, it means I like you, because we're just having fun together. We're learning together.
Should I buy the 64 ounces? I mean, we do have a lot of laundry. Or should I go 96 and work on my biceps? Carry something heavy home.
Not only do I want them to be able to do math and to problem solve, but I want them to be able to communicate with other students. So every day we try to do some work with another student, especially in this day and age with social media. Kids are not always prepared to practice their social skills and to communicate with other people. So I want them to be good communicators. I want them to learn to be good listeners. I want them to be good citizens, and I want them to be responsible for their own learning.
We're finding unit rates.
I was so honored when I was selected here in our district. I just feel really humbled that I would be chosen. And I had no idea that this award is involving me in policy in South Dakota. I'm learning a lot that way. It's giving me an opportunity to share ideas and to speak with other people in the state, which, I mean, I love teaching. I love my work here. And this has just opened up a whole new world for me that I wasn't expecting. What keeps me teaching is I get a lot of payback, a lot of reward from working with kids. They are our most important resource in South Dakota.
That's South Dakota's Teacher of the Year, Beth Keltsulis. When we come back, we talk crime with Sioux Falls Police Chief Matt Burns. Stay in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The 2016 Sioux Falls Police Crime Statistics Report has been released. On the heels of that report and the media coverage that followed, Sioux Falls Police Chief Matt Burns joins the program with thoughts on safety and statistics. Chief, welcome to In the Moment.
Yes, thank you.
So give me the big picture here. What's the overview of the crime statistics for 2016 in Sioux Falls?
Well, certainly there's some things in this report that don't surprise us as we've been tracking these closely and, in fact, talking about them on a regular basis throughout the year. Our narcotics cases investigated by our Sioux Falls Area Drug Task Force did increase by over 360 cases. That is commensurate with what we've seen in the number of drug seizures as far as some of the hard drugs like methamphetamine, heroin, and cocaine, and the arrests are also in line with those numbers. This is not a positive development for our community or our state, as we've seen increasing narcotics cases and arrests and seizures go up clear across the state. Now, while there are some troubling patterns there, I will and should note that some of the things that we track also decreased, and we saw decreases in burglaries and larcenies, vandalisms, things like that. Some of these things are cyclical, and they take dips, and they have some increases in certain years, but overall, the increase in the narcotics issues and problems are troubling.
Hmm. What about crime and violent crime against people that is not drug-related? Do you have a way of separating that out?
Well, typically through the investigations that is ferreted out in a sense, we see that the vast majority of that type of crime, except for some of the domestic issues, are largely drug or related or chemically induced somehow, and alcohol plays a strong part in that as well. We saw some increases in our aggravated assaults, over 22 cases beyond what we investigated last year, and also a small increase in our aggravated assault domestics. So some of those things are relatively steady in reference to our population. I should note that just yesterday we had a population estimate released for Sioux Falls of 178,500, and that is about 5,200 more citizens that we estimate in our city than the last estimate of recent times. So certainly some of these things increase as your population does, and some of them are increasing, such as the narcotics cases, at a rate greater than the population.
We've covered the Women's March in Sioux Falls, Rapid City, and Vermilion this week, and one of the key issues was violence against women. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that from what's happening in Sioux Falls now.
Well, and I noted just a few moments ago that our cases in that regard did increase by a few over 20, and that's never a positive sign. Unfortunately, the domestic violence situation has been with us, as it is across the broader society, for some time, and it we continue to combat that. We have a lot of close community partners that we rely upon heavily to combat that. We have a strong messaging piece in reference to domestic violence all the time. So we certainly encourage things like that bring awareness to the domestic violence issues. We work, again, in close concert with those support agencies that really do a lot of good for the victims in those instances.
Let's talk about the department a little bit. As population increases, as crime increases, does your department size increase? Do you have more officers on the street?
Yes, in fact, in 2017, we were authorized 4 additional officers for a total sworn strength of 256. That authorization went approval by the city administration and the city council. Very shortly, we'll be tooling up our 2018 budget process, and with the increase in population, some of these numbers, and just the increase overall of the activity in our city, we'll probably be looking for additional officers for the next budget cycle. Just a little early to be projecting that, but I would say that our own police department calls for service increased by over 7,200 calls from 2015 to 2016 to just under 104,000 calls for service.
So let's go back to the narcotics cases, because that's key, I think, to this report. Drug Task Force, does that also increase as well? And tell me a little bit about what they do.
Yes, in fact, just late last year, based upon some of these increasing numbers, I did authorize one more full-time detective to be placed from the Sioux Falls Police Department on our drug task force for a total of 6 detectives just from our department. That task force is made up by Minnehaha County deputies, agents from the Division of Criminal Investigation from the state, as well as some federal agencies. And that drug task force, again, investigated over 2,770 cases this past year alone, and they tell me that over 85% of their cases has to deal with methamphetamine trafficking abuse. And
say that percentage again, 85%?
85% has to do with methamphetamine. But even at that, you know, we've seen increases in some of our narcotics, the heroin case is part of the narcotics piece. And but even inside of that, the trafficking of the marijuana, a lot of the marijuana that's even grown in legal states makes its way outside those state borders. And frankly, we see that here as well.
How has the legalization of marijuana in other states impacted South Dakota then? You see more of it. How else?
Well, I can tell you that in some of the states that have legalized it, there is so much legal marijuana being grown there. They don't have the market to support it internally, and it gets illicitly trafficked into other states. That's a fact. We see that. The trafficking routes are being interdicted by law enforcement, you know, in all directions from these states. So the issues and the problems just don't stay inside the states where it's legalized. It becomes a problem for the border states and beyond.
Do you know, have you talked to police chiefs or sheriffs from those states to see what happens with their drug use and drug cases overall once marijuana is legalized? Do they see a drop?
I don't know that they've seen a drop. I've seen reports, and I've been at chiefs' conferences where this is discussed broadly. Yeah. And they do see increases in like driving while under the impairment of the psychoreactive element of marijuana, THC. You know, mm-hmm. that increases. They see increased usage in their youth because just folks get desensitized to it. Even the youth, if it becomes legal for adults, then, you know, it just becomes generally desensitized. And I certainly don't see that as a positive development for our society.
Do they see increase in use of other drugs as well, or do they not know how that impacts using meth and heroin?
Yeah, I haven't seen any numbers on that yet, but I can tell you that as the trafficking routes open up from these states where the excess marijuana is being brought through, that it's certainly a trafficking route opens up to all drugs then. And so we've seen a great increase in methamphetamine trafficking into the state of South Dakota from the super labs across the border to our south. We see very, very few instances in these days of homegrown or meth labs like we used to see in past years because the availability of methamphetamine is so great through being trafficked through the southern border, and there's never been more availability, and the price has never been lower, and that certainly equates to the increase in narcotics cases we're investigating and the problems from it.
Talk to me a little bit about officer safety, and do you track that at all? Are there any changes that you've seen as drug crimes increase with how your officers prepare to deal with it?
Well, certainly. Anytime you're introducing more of a highly volatile controlled substance into your community, it poses a greater threat not only to the citizens but certainly the officers. The folks that are under the influence of these things, and when you increase in the number of cases and arrests, it tells you there's a lot more folks that are using these substances, and anytime you deal with them, they're more volatile, they're more unpredictable, and they're ultimately more violent in their interactions with law enforcement, especially in an arrest situation. So our officers are trained to recognize these characteristics. They're trained to be very, very careful and mindful of how a person under the influence of a controlled substance might react to them. And, you know, it just becomes a more dangerous situation, and it's very concerning for us in regards to our officer safety.
What kind of conversations do you have with those officers about their safety and about how they're dealing with the community right now?
Well, first and foremost, they need to understand that the vast majority of the persons and the citizens of Sioux Falls are law-abiding. They support what they're doing. They need every officer to know and understand that they appreciate that the public service that the officers provide. But they also need to understand that as our population increases, as these numbers of hard drugs increase in our community, and thereby the number of persons using them, that they have to be more careful all the time. And aware of their surroundings, aware of the circumstances, and aware of the behaviors that are certainly potential for them to see when dealing with a person under the influence. It's something that is omnipresent in their mind because it has to be, because they're out there, I guess, in a sense, in harm's way all the time.
Hmm. I'm looking at the traffic statistics. Let's close with this. I don't see anything about texting. Is that something you track then? How many people have been getting tickets for texting while driving or seatbelt enforcement?
Yeah, we didn't. The specific texting while driving stats weren't a part of this report.
Okay.
But we did do several initiatives and saturation patrols specifically referencing to texting while driving this past year. It started out with an education initiative where we wanted our citizens to be aware that we were taking a more serious bent towards this, and we did issue several warnings at the outset along with information cards and for the citizens. The second and subsequent efforts in this regard did take more of an enforcement tact, and we did issue a number of citations. I don't have that number right in front of me, but but the citizens of Sioux Falls are aware that that is something that we're taking more seriously. I think our messaging piece emphasizes how we view it, and that is a big danger not only to the vehicular but pedestrian traffic if there's an additional distractions inside the vehicle, and that officers are ticketing for that.
Chief Burns, we had a guest on last week who had been in a terrible accident texting while driving, and I'll just never look at my phone in the car again. So be safe out there, and thanks for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Yes, well, I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Chief Matt Burns is with the Sioux Falls Police Department. After the break, gather around the table. Hugh Weber returns with news from the Potluck Society. You're in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We're broadcasting today live from the studios at the University of Sioux Falls. Hugh Weber is with me in the studio. He's the founder of the Potluck Society, SDPB contributor. He joins us every Tuesday with fresh dishes of creativity and innovation. Hugh, thanks for being here again.
It is so great to be back.
Let's go ahead and turn up your microphone for starters. There.
I'm happy to be here.
That's on my end. All right. Who are you bringing us to? You know what? First, tell me about this meeting. You had an actual meeting of folks in person.
So we had the first actual gathering of the Potluck Society. There were 12 people around a table, complete with Sloppy Joes and Angel Food Cake. I mean, this was as good as it gets right in the dining room of my house. We talked about a lot of the future episodes of the podcast as it launches. Those pieces will become part of that audio experience. So we'll be inviting people to come sit with me, break bread, and talk about the extraordinary things happening. This week also happened to be on the tail of the documentary that's being filmed around ODA and the Potluck Society. So we just spent 10 days on the road collecting over 20 hours of video and audio that we'll be sharing through the same.
All right. Who are you bringing us today?
I get to bring one of my very favorites today to the table. Jason Roberts is a Dallas native. He is an extraordinary community builder, and he's the founder of the Better Block Project and now the Better Block Foundation. He believes in cheap, temporary, high-impact art and community engagements to improve our communities. But let me have him introduce himself.
I'm Jason Roberts, living in Dallas, Texas, based in Dallas, Texas. Have a project called the Better Block. I started in 2010 with some neighbors where we looked at kind of our city, our neighborhood, and we started trying to figure out ways that we could make it a place that was more desirable for the community, because we had a lot of things like wide high-speed streets, and we had thin sidewalks, we had no landscaping, we had empty buildings, lots of vacancies, and we tried to come in and figure out, like, how can we turn these places around to make them the kind of places we see in other cities that people love, and they want these destinations that kind of support like small local businesses and have like little main streets and cafe seating and things like that. And so when we started studying the problems in our neighborhood, we realized there was a lot of ordinances and zoning rules that made it either illegal or cost prohibitive to make our places come to life. So we had like zoning in our buildings changed from retail to light industrial, and we had streets that were converted into high speed, wide, one way streets so people could get out of the suburbs as fast as possible. And then we had things a lot of ordinances, like it was either going to be illegal or cost prohibitive to make our places come to life. So we had ordinances that said it was $1,000 in permitting to do flowers on the sidewalk, and it was going to be $1,000 for cafe seating and permitting, or $1,000 for shade awning. So what we did with the Better Block was we came together with our neighborhood and said, let's take a weekend and find out if we can just break every rule and law we possibly can to make this the kind of place we wish we always had. So We gathered our neighbors and we painted our own bike lanes. We thinned the streets ourselves. We painted murals. We added, we took the empty buildings and we put the businesses we wish we always had. So we put in bookstores and cafes and flower shops and art spaces for kids. And then we printed off all the laws and the rules we were breaking. We invited our city staff and our mayor out to kind of see, like, look, this place is not working and we are frustrated and we want to see a change. And instead of going to jail, we fortunately the city staff and mayor came out and said, this is a much better way to build a city. And we did this temporarily, and again, we did it rapidly, and they started making changes. So we saw zoning change, and we saw a lot of ordinances change. We saw businesses that we made temporary become permanent. We developed it into this open source model because other cities wanted to do the same thing in their neighborhoods. So now we have a nonprofit foundation that we've created that where we get to do work all over the world and support other Better Block projects.
Amazing. And so you've been to this region through the ODA organization. You've been to Fargo and Bismarck and even Milbank, South Dakota. What does when you're not simply a speaker, when you're doing a workshop or when you're doing an intervention in a Better Block project, what does that look like? When you arrive day one, have you already done a lot of the homework, or is it a learn as you go type process and engagement from the community? What does that work look like?
Yeah, so it starts really by going to like a neighborhood. We're often invited in by a neighborhood that says, look, we have problems and we want to fix things. We realize that we're stuck and things aren't happening. And we've done a lot of planning initiatives and we've had a lot of this neighborhood meetings and discussions. So we gather that neighborhood together in a room. Actually, we typically go into a blighted area in the neighborhood, or a place that they know that they want this to be turned around. And we start asking questions and very simply, like, what's wrong with this area? What's missing here? What would make this better? What do you love about it? What don't you like about it? And then neighbors kind of come together and they start kind of putting down whiteboards and start, you know, coming up with all these ideas and things they wish they had. The nice thing is too, we get out of the town hall format, out of city halls, and we take them right to the areas where the problems are. So you're not getting kind of these abstract notions of ways to fix an area. It's more very specific. Like, people can see that those windows are broken. That paint is peeling over there. There's no businesses. These are vacant buildings. And then we start trying to find out, like, okay, these are, let's say, the 5 or 10 things that were themes that kept coming up that you wanted to have happen in your neighborhood. What are the assets? What are the skills we have here? And so we start kind of making like this menu of resources. So we'll say, like, well, you know, we have lots of old pallets that can be deconstructed and used for wood. For construction, and we've got people in our neighborhood that are great at cooking or great at graphic design. And so we start mapping all of that out and trying to tie together the assets and the resources to the needs of the neighborhood. And then we set up kind of a rapid roadmap and time frame for these things to get laid out. So we'll say, okay, let's in 90 days, what are we going to do to kind of fulfill some of these ideas or these dreams of the neighborhood? And so really, the magic of the project is making everybody work really quickly and making them kind of in the idea that is to get them around this idea of coming up with worst case scenarios, which will often happen, or coming up with any kind of roadblocks that people will put up and just say, look, we're already on the hook. We publicized this date. There's going to be this thing. And then it makes everybody work quickly and it makes everybody work together because you have to work together at this point and you get to know your neighbors really, really well. And things start hitting on the ground. And like I said, oftentimes they start off as temporary, but little things kind of bubble up from that. And, you know, what the big thing is it's raising the social capital of the area, which you need that in order to start any project, right? You need the community talking and getting to know each other and rebuilding trust and figuring out what's their shared humanity? What's the things that we know we want to have better in our neighborhood? We know we all have kids. We want our kids to feel safe. And we've got grandparents and we want them to feel like they have a place that they can go because they're retired, but we want them to feel part of the neighborhood as well. How do we, if we know we all have these shared things and needs, what are we doing together to make sure that we can make this a better place for all of us?
That's beautiful. One of the things that Zach and I had a chance to talk about was that he finds that there's this public-facing layer that often looks like a block party or looks like a citywide level. And then there's this secondary layer for him that's about more fundamental change, the way people perceive things. Maybe he brings them for the block party, but then he's able to test out a new parking layout or something. Do you approach your work in the same way? Is there this kind of basic level of completing and building blocks, but also a more subversive kind of changing of hearts and minds?
Absolutely. Yeah. So you've hit right on it where we go in and oftentimes people don't realize even with a better block bet, because we want to be available to a lot of people that maybe weren't in the planning session, just like having them fall into this new environment that's been reshaped temporarily, and people will start commenting on it. So like, let's say we take a block and we bring out, you know, a lot of trees to shade it, and we bring out cafe seating, and we make like a little cafe with a neighborhood. It's a little bit subversive in the sense, because there's a lot of the people coming to this that weren't part of that. They're just like, this is amazing. They're taking all these pictures and they're talking to people in the neighborhood, and then the businesses that are already just in the area, they're getting the spillover effect because there's more people coming out to this space because it's more beautiful and it's more inviting. And then at that point, it's a lot easier whenever you have to queue up changes, usually at a city hall level, which says like, look, we have restrictions on cafes and we have restrictions. And then we can kind of go to the city hall, like, well, look, we just had that weekend where we did all this activity and programming and we changed the landscape and people loved it. And it was very successful. And you'll just, those little tiny like gatherings were what really were used as kind of the data, that, cause in the end we found that for a city, nothing matters unless it's been counted. So we basically created an event or a party to start counting and gathering metrics to show how people really use space and how to make it better.
The neighborhood he's talking about.
Yeah.
Because then we got to talk about cafe seating and how it applies to South Dakota. Tell me about his neighborhood.
Jason lives in this extraordinary neighborhood in the Bishop's Art District, a neighborhood called Oak Cliff, that up until recently was known as the home of the theater that Lee Harvey Oswald escaped to and was arrested in 1963. But now is this extraordinary place that has, you know, I was there for an afternoon last summer, early fall. I spent some time on the porch of a place called Oddfellows, an incredible bar with a patio, then went and got some of the best barbecue I've ever had in my life, and then spent a little bit of the evening wandering the aisles of this really tiny bookstore called The Wild Detectives. It was the perfect afternoon. And 10 years ago, 15 years ago, this was a place that was seen as the seedy part of Dallas, which is saying something, right?
Right.
And so I think it's the intentionality with which Jason approaches his neighborhood, but neighborhoods in general. He sees it really from an assets-based perspective. I think one of the challenges we have in this region, my work of the last several years, is that we tend to have a scarcity narrative about the things we lack. Even if we see that as a good thing, we talk about the absence of things. And the thing that you heard Jason say in that clip is that they look first at the assets. What are the things we have? Do we have a couple of people that are good at painting buildings? Do we have some extra hammers? You know, what are the things that we have, even if they seem relatively insignificant, that might contribute to that better block approach?
I like the concept of a wide road that you want to get out of this place as quickly as possible versus a place to stop and sort of pause. And then I'm also attracted to this, what he said about magic is making everything work really quickly.
Yeah, and he has this interesting concept of blackmailing yourself, that so often we have these really great ideas, best of intentions, but we don't take the next step of putting a date on the calendar and telling our neighbors. But once you've done that, once you've taken that step of saying, we're going to do this thing on this date at this location, you've blackmailed yourself from a social capital and social, you know, sociality perspective. You know, mm-hmm. People are going to see you differently if you don't follow through. So putting positive peer pressure on yourself is something that gets these things moving forward. Keep them brief. Keep them limited. Don't think you have to, you know, build something permanent or build something really expensive. Do those temporary, lightweight things that actually do pivot community.
When you say social capital, what does that mean exactly?
So for me, social capital is all of the value that's tied up in our relationships. So this in practical terms are things like our civic involvement or our communal involvement. But they're also things like the fact that my neighbor has a really nice snowblower. And if he's got a little extra time, he blows out my walk as well. These relationships, this transfer of value that ultimately accumulates in community. It accumulates in whether things are thriving and growing and mutual and shared, or if they're distinct and separate and deficit focused.
Let's go back to cafe seating, because the weather is coming in across this state. And so I'm wondering how some of what Jason's talking about that might make sense in Dallas, how do we transfer that to stuff that makes sense for small towns or any community in a larger city in South Dakota?
Yeah, I think these things look differently depending on where you're located, but all have value to consider. You know, we act surprised each and every winter that it's arrived. That somehow this is a time for us to close our doors and become secluded. We've known for the hundreds of years that people have been wandering these plains that every year, like clockwork, somewhere between September and December, we're going to get snow and winter's going to come. Why don't we design a lifestyle and a series of communities that thrive in that situation? Why don't we look at the spaces that we have that may be interior? It may not be street-side seating in the middle of January, but what spaces do we have that we can congregate and be communal and share together? And so in some cases, Milbank is a great example. Milbank had a workshop with Jason, and they immediately recognized that it had been years since they had had a thriving ice skating rink. And they committed as a group of volunteers that were one table of a dozen to focus on that. And this year did their second rink in the new year, all just from the spark of saying, what do we have? We know we have winter. We know we're going to get some ice out of that. What do we have, and how do we create community out of that? And I think that, Jason and I continued our conversation in a way that really focused on some of that small town application as well.
So you visited Milbank, which is 3,300 people, about a little over a year and a half ago, and we saw some really direct impacts as far as ripples from that session. You're going to visit Aberdeen, South Dakota, which is a little larger, but for an event called Rural X later this year. Tell me a little bit about how this work can exist in small towns or rural communities. How do you see it applying when it's not in a significant metro area, but maybe is in a little bit off the grid or off the main road?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'd say the interesting, I think, in a small town, you have a lot better ability, I think, to connect people, because people think that in a big city that just, you have so many people and so many resources, it's easy. But the larger the city, almost the more lonely it can be, because if people are kind of in these bubbles where they're afraid to communicate because they're just passing so many people regularly. Where in a small town, I found people are okay with the concept of relying on each other, on helping each other out. But also, I would say, what I love, especially when communities are kind of more of a farm-based rural community, they are very used to like building and making things together and using these. A lot of the equipment we'll get are from feed stores. Like we'll bring horse troughs in that we're making water fountains out of. And there's a lot of equipment that's used kind of in an agricultural means that has to be large scale that can be easily deployed into a neighborhood or in a small neighborhood, Main Street or something. And usually the neighbors in the community know how to like do like light things like welding and general like metal fabrication that can be used to help build a better community. And I find it's a lot easier in these rural communities. But the other thing too is, one of the big inspirations for me for Better Block started from driving through my parents' old small towns in Oklahoma where they grew up, which my mom was from a town of 700 people and my father was a town of 5,000 people. But I would drive through their little main streets, and they all have these little main streets of small zero lot line buildings built to the sidewalk. And most of them were empty. And when I drive through with my parents, they would talk about how this is where the pharmacist was. We all knew the pharmacist, and this was the little diner that we all went to, and this was the little bookstore we all went to. We gathered here, and this is we all would, all these merchants would put the parades on. We'd have our parades here. So it was kind of being embedded in those small towns of 1,000 to 5,000 that really made me realize you could do this anywhere, and this is what everyone has. The need to gather, even if they're, especially I would say in a rural environment where there's more probably social isolation, you know, this is the idea of creating the farmer's market where the farmers all come into town together. And that was a place where everyone got together and celebrated, you know, and it had, you know, kids got to play together and juniors got to see the kids and all kinds of great things. So I think it's almost easier to see projects stick and get on the ground in these communities because of the resources.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Radio. My guest is Hugh Weber. That's him talking to Jason Roberts, Dallas-based founder of the Better Block Project, chair of the Better Block Foundation. Open source model here. Tell me what that means in regards to Better Block.
Well, I think Jason made a decision a number of years ago that he either had to kind of hoard the knowledge that he was accumulating in how to build community, or he had to make the choice in kind of a software mindset to give it to the world and see what it looked like when other people execute it. He came from a background in IT, oddly enough, and from a background in web design and web development. And I think it was just natural for him to open it up to the world. And so there may be times where he sees that work based on some of the principles that he's laid out that looks a little differently, not exactly how he might do it in a community. But there's magic in the fact that that ownership is shared and that he might learn something from someone else doing the work as well.
Take me back around that table at your house and the voices that you heard. And what kind of ideas are you hearing back from listeners about Potluck Society, what they want it to be? What do you want it to be?
Yeah, I think this first in-person gathering was an important step because it was both symbolic of where we hope to go, where everyone can contribute. And that's something we've seen a lot of already, people sending me names through social media, through thepotlucksociety.com, of people that they want to see featured. But what was amazing about that conversation is how quickly it evolved. I would throw out a prompt based on an episode coming up, like the conversation with Justin Smith about connection and neurology and all these things. I thought I was going to interview a social scientist to compliment him, and it became clear within moments there was a writer in the group. And she said that what she really would like to think about in terms of connection is how social media is affecting it. So this sparked a 15-minute conversation about social media that ultimately will maybe the best radio and best podcast we produce in a completely impromptu conversation. Yeah. And so now I'm seeking through Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, I'm seeking someone that can speak to the psychology of relationship as it relates to social media, which is not where I started. So if I hope to tell stories informed by community and engage with community, those sessions are where I'm going to find that response and get a sense of direction.
Hugh Weber, we'll see you next week. Thanks so much for joining us. PotluckSociety.com. Is that where I start?
ThePotluckSociety.com.
ThePotluckSociety.com. Hugh Weber, thanks.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Chris Lawfrey and Steve Zwemke, executive producer Kara Hetland. Tomorrow is Wednesday, so the Dakota Political Junkies will be with us. We'll also hear from Sandy Kading, who was at the inauguration of President Donald Trump, representing South Dakota with the Republican National Committee. Victoria Wicks brings you scenes from a celebration of Irish poet Robert Burns, and we'll also talk about Alzheimer's in South Dakota and why every second counts. I'm Lori Walsh. We'll see you tomorrow. Thank you for listening.